Well, good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for joining us, and welcome to CSIS. My name is Richard Downey, and I'm Deputy Director of the Africa Programme here. And welcome to the launch of our latest publication. I hope you managed to pick up a copy. You should find one on your seats, Building Police Institutions in Fragile States, which examines the challenges faced by police in three African states, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and South Sudan. Looks at what the United States is doing to assist and tries to come up with a few thoughts on what might be done better or differently. This work follows on from an earlier project we did at CSIS, which looked from the angle of what the US government could do to sort of organize its assets to support police development overseas and try to unpick some of the domestic constraints, the bureaucratic financial constraints here, which mean that the policing issue overseas doesn't get the attention it deserves or makes the impact it seeks to make. The motivation generally for this effort is the feeling that poor policing is a major barrier to the consolidation of peace, security, and democratic development in Africa. And it's also a neglected policy issue here in the United States, which has tended to focus security sector assistance on militaries rather than police. Now, the three case studies in this report are hardly a representative sample in Africa terms. They're all very fragile post-conflict states. In the case of South Sudan, you could even argue whether it's even become a post-conflict state yet. So these are very, very tough environments for the police. They're tough places to undertake successful reform and police development. So in the circumstances, you could argue, and we do a little bit in the report, that the police, despite their clear limitations, have actually done a fairly decent job in tough circumstances. The Liberian police got through a very contentious election in 2011. It's dealt with really chronic insecurity on its border with Cote d'Ivoire. The Sierra Leone police managed to get through an equally contentious election period just a matter of a couple of months ago. And even in South Sudan, the police there did a surprisingly decent job of providing security over the referendum period, which led to independence there. That said, the challenges are enormous, and we outline them in some detail in the report. The United States is trying to help in a variety of ways. They range from providing police trainers and mentors through UN operations in Liberia and South Sudan, setting up armed response units, for example, in Liberia, and instructing the police in Sierra Leone on how to provide election security. There have been some successes, and we'll hear about them, but too often the approach has been hampered by lack of funds, difficulties in getting the right people for the job, bureaucratic tangles, confused objectives in some cases. Now, it's pretty difficult to draw very broad lessons from these three specific case studies, but there are a couple of issues that keep popping up. You can read them out about them in the report, so I won't go into detail, but just a couple to mention before we move on to our panel. One was the difficulty in making programs sustainable when funding is so short-term or uncertain. This means that the long-term institution-building effort, which is crucial in policing, is often discarded in favor of identifying and selecting working with so-called reform-minded individuals, which may only have a passing, people who may only really have a passing impact on a police organization in the long run. Another dilemma was how to integrate the short-term operational objectives with long-term developmental ones. In tough post-war places where security is shaky, you know, how do you get police on the ground doing their jobs in a hurry while at the same time building the systems and institutions which will allow them to operate efficiently, professionally, and accountability down the line? A third big issue is how you deal with that set of difficult countries, some of them in this report, where the basic conditions for successful reform are absent. What do you do when a host country lacks the political will to reform its police? Are there ways of getting around this problem, or are we effectively just wasting our money in our attempt to do so? big questions, but we have some big minds to tackle them this afternoon, and I'm sure we'll get to some answers by the end of our hour and a half session. Let me just briefly introduce the speakers. You have their biographies, but kicking off this afternoon, Dr. Mataran Unikpo is Academic Chair of Civil Military Relations at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, an institute which we refer to a lot for their expertise on security sector reform. In the middle, we have Mark Croker, who's the Senior Vice President for Justice and Rule of Law at PAE. Has had an illustrious police career, both domestically here in the US, but also in international service, including Deputy Commissioner of the International Police Task Force in the UN mission in Bosnia-Herzegovina, and also relevantly for our discussion today, Police Commissioner of the UNMIL, the UN Police mission in Liberia, immediately after the end of the war. Finally, on my far left, Eric Beinhardt is Associate Director of the Department of Justice's International Criminal and Investigative Training Assistance Program, the most hard organization to remember, or the ISITAP for short. He's currently on detail to USAID, where he's the DOJ's liaison to the Center of Excellence on Democracy, Human Rights, and Governance in the Democracy, Conflict, and Humanitarian Affairs Bureau. Has worked in way in excess of a dozen African countries alone on police reform and development, most recently in Sierra Leone, and we'll be hearing a bit about that effort today. So without further ado, I'm going to turn the floor over to Dr. Matt. Come up here and we'll hear your thoughts about the challenges police in Africa are facing. Over to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Richard. First of all, let me just thank CSIS and the staff for organizing this event. Quite often when I hear about security sector reform, we are most of the time addressing the military side. So I was very pleased to know that we are going to be discussing police today. And I also like this whole debate, if you don't mind, to be couched in civil-military relations. That's what we are really dealing with. And if you look at the continent, the health of civil-military relations is not that great because right what happened right after independence. Ideally, African countries should rethink the whole security sector or civil-military relations. But for whatever reason, they didn't really do that. So they just accepted the colonial armies and continued with those armies. The same thing happened with police. Ideally, given how the police has behaved during colonialism, you think after independence, there will be some thought to what kind of police do we need? Because to me, that's the biggest issue that we don't really address, even within the academic circle. The first question should be, do African societies need a police? To me, that should be the first question. If yes, what type of police for what mission? So this question were never asked, let alone answered. So what happened? We end up in post-colonial or independent Africa with colonial police. So when you have colonial police with a dictatorship or with authoritarianism, what you end up with is basically two bad sides. So that's why when you look at the continent, is hardly any country you can go to and see the people really liking, enjoying, or having a good attitude, a good feeling vis-a-vis the police. Okay. African police forces, if you go back to colonial time, they were simply imposed upon African countries. There was no legitimacy from neither the people nor the regime in place. Okay. They were badly paid and corrupt, poor relations with the army, because during colonialism, the army was the center of a security sector, not police. And so what happened after independence? The same attitude, behavior simply continued. African, as I said earlier, simply did not transform, adapt the police to their societies. So we have a poorly trained, poorly equipped, badly paid, and corrupt police. If you have that, what you end up with is instead of having the police protecting or providing security, the police became the institution you need protection against, which is the core of why police in Africa tend to be in this kind of situation. The second issue is those who came to power. Instead of devoting or allowing the police to play its role, which is crowd control, law enforcement, and other providing internal security, they simply didn't do that because of how they came to power, most of them. So what happened? They end up giving a lot of weapon, resources, means to the army. When you do that, what happened? Instead of the police playing its role, now you have the army stepping in whenever you have a crowd control problem. So right there, you have some kind of a confused role. Now, in terms of characteristic of contemporary African police, of course, police is the civil force of the state responsible for the prevention and detection of crime and maintenance of public order. Crucial role is to establish internal security and uphold the rule of law. But since independence, most African police forces have suffered of poor governance. That's really what happened. You have political interference that eroded professionalism and led to ethnically and geographically biased recruitment. You have most police, the recruitment is based on who is the Minister of Interior, Minister of Security, as opposed to being professional, as opposed to being qualified. Now, in terms of police state society dynamics or the challenges Richard was talking about, torture remains unfortunately common practice on the continent because the police is unaccountable simply because of impunity, and democratic opposition forces are often silenced. So there's simply nobody to check on the police, how they are behaving. So you have abuses of power by the police. You have rape, torture, extortion, violence. They are so common that they are no longer taken as mistakes. That's really the norm, as opposed to the exception. If you go to any country once in a while, you see police kind of mistakes through rape or some kind of attitude. But in sub-Saharan Africa, that seems to be the norm, simply because the police just, they behave as though there's nobody to check on them. So you have that kind of impunity going on. Even the prison system, inherited from colonial rulers, is no longer aimed at righting wrongs or compensating injuries to the individual or society at large. In most of these countries, the authorities' approach to crime is entirely repressive. So prison no longer serves the purpose of rehabilitating offenders. You go to prison that was built for maybe 10 people, you end up with 100, you just got rotten there, there's no justice system trying to try your case or whatever, you are just there forgotten almost. Okay? You have impunity, misbehavior, that led to a lot of self-defense, kind of unregulated self-defense on the continent. So Africans have basically taken matter in their own hand. And when you have that, you continue having abuses and other kind of violence going on. The whole concept of a monopoly of force or violence that Max Weber talks about eloquently. If you go to the African country, most countries are not really, and they don't have that monopoly over violence. Yet you need that associated with rule of law to make sure somebody is really delivering security. So in most African countries, you don't have that. According to an UN survey, Africans seem to be most severe on thieves. When you steal somebody's good on the continent, they are really, really tough on you. Unlike vendettas, which are at least conform to specific social rules, you have the lynching of a thief caught in the act in the market, for example, is not part of any system of justice. You do whatever you can because the police will not come. And sometimes you have police, you take a thief to the police station. If you are not lucky, before you get home, he's already waiting for you in your own house. Because of the way the system works, if you happen to have somebody within that police station or the whole governance of a security sector, a criminal might end up back waiting for you, and he's supposed to be in police custody. So you have this kind of situation going on. Unfortunately, what is being observed on the continent, you have a necklace system, meaning self-defense. Instead of taking a thief or somebody, a criminal, to the police, people want to kind of distribute or administer their own justice. So you have a necklace in South Africa. You have what is known as Article 320 in Mali, which is ironically 300 for a liter of petrol, and 20 francs for the match that you buy. So that's 320, 320. That's what they call the system to burn you alive in Mali. If you go to Nigeria, they call it witi. They just pour, gas on you, and there you go. Simply because their perception is that police is not responsive. You bring the police in, you are not going to get justice. Okay. Now, that's why we have now a lot of private security. Okay, you have a lot of private security on the continent. And unfortunately, when you go deeper into those private security, most of the time you have some ministers or some high-level authority. They are the one creating private security parallel to the state security. And since the state is deficient, therefore everybody tend to go to private security. That's a very serious issue we are kind of dealing with on the continent. Now, all this leads to the need to reform. Need to reform, but we got to be very careful here when we talk about reform. First of all, we have to reform the whole entire security sector. By that, I mean the military, gendarme, police, even the justice system, prisons, parliament, we all have a role. They all have a role to play in reforming, not just police, not just gendarme per se. And they all need to go at the same time. We also need to take into account the culture. There's a culture on the continent that we need to really address, and those of us country that are trying to go and help, you got to be very careful when you go in. Do they need help? If yes, what kind of help can I give them? As opposed to, can I help you? Here is what I have. So we got to be very careful. That's why you have a country like Congo or other places where the West has been helping for almost 20, 30, whatever years. And yet there's nothing really to show. Because we are pouring money into whatever we think we are helping. But at the receiving end, we really don't have these guys taking into account what we are telling them to do. So I think to me we need to really be careful and make sure when we go into reform, we take into account the whole issue of accountability and oversight. Basically, somebody has to be watching the watchman. Somebody has to guard the guardian. And that's part of the whole security sector reform, again, that we need to make sure justice system is working, is functioning, the judges, the magistrates, everybody's playing, their partition within society. It's not just a matter of focusing on police in Sierra Leone. All these are wonderful. But if you only focus on Sierra Leone, DRC, and others, the police, as opposed to the whole society for that matter, you won't have much to show for as a result. So, in a way, what I'm kind of discussing is African police, they are going to need external assistance, no question about it. And the job that CSIS is doing and so many of you are involved in is laudable. But once again, we need to really be careful and we need to bring in civil society. Because within any democratic setting, you got to make sure you have a watchdog, somebody's really watching the police, the gendarme, all of them, what they are doing in the name of the people. Otherwise, people who are supposed to be those institutions that are supposed to be delivering security in most African countries up to now, you have a lot of problems going on, and they actually end up delivering insecurity. You don't have to go any further if you just look at most countries on the continent. When they talk about police, gendarme, especially the intelligence service, these are folks who believe they are beyond reform. They are untouchable. Nobody should touch them. They are like a black hole. And yet, you cannot be black hole. Within any democratic setting, you really need to be accountable to the people. If you really don't want to die, get out of the kitchen because the heat is too much. So, in a nutshell, the police is the most dysfunctional and underperforming institution in sub-Saharan Africa. And the report shows that, no question about it. Now, the most fundamental question to me, What next? What do we do? How do we make sure we move the police from that category? And for that matter, not just the police, as I said earlier, but the whole security sector. And I'm really, really pleading you all, if you go to reforming any institution on the continent, make sure you bear in mind the whole sector. Security sector is not military alone. It's not gendarme or police. We are talking about the whole sector for that matter. So how do we make sure we move the police from being dysfunctional to becoming effective entity within society to deliver genuine security? That's all what I have to share with you. Thank you very much for listening, and I'm ready for any question you might have. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Well, Matt's done a great job of setting the scene for us, laying out the challenges in pretty bleak terms. So, Mark, over to you. What's the international community been doing, and what lessons have we learned?
Well, thank you very much, and it's a real pleasure for me to be here with you this afternoon and to join into this discussion about police and Africa. And I will tell you, as a boy growing up in the Congo, in Bandundu province, one of my first experiences with the police was with my father as we stood next to a police station in the city of Kikwit. And there in the afternoon sun were elephant hide whips hanging on the side of the police station. I said to my father, "What are those?" And he said, "That is what the Belgians teach the Congolese police to use to keep the population in control." That was, and I was maybe 6 years old at the time. I grew up in the Congo, and all of these years, that memory has stayed with me. And now, after many, many years of policing and serving in UN missions delivering police capacity building programs, that memory, that passion for good police, who, as you heard, serve the people and look after them and are not the ones that will be exploiting them. That is a deep, deep passion of mine. And I'm very, very pleased to be part of this conversation this afternoon. And thank you for the invitations. Congratulations, Richard, on a wonderful paper. I have no argument with it. I'm free to have arguments of my own, and I do on occasion. But with that, I have a full endorsement on everything that is there. And I think it's a wonderful piece to be floating around to generate some good thought. I would also be remiss if I didn't introduce two of my colleagues who are with me from PAE, where I now work in the delivery of justice and rule of law programs, as you've heard. Bob Reschke is with us, one of our vice presidents, and also Daryl Conway is here with us from PAE. So if you have a chance to talk with them about some of the other things that are going on in PAE, that would be a very good thing. Well, I want to be very brief, and I will take the opportunity to not only be brief, but to be thorough. And how to do that, I'm not quite sure, but I will give it a try. I think as I stand behind this lectern of a speech where the senior Bill Marriott, the founder of the chain of hotels, received an award. And upon the receipt of that award, they said to him, "Mr. Marriott, would you please say one thing that you would say to all the guests in all the Marriott hotels around the world?" Mr. Marriott stepped up to the microphone and without hesitation said, "The shower curtain goes on the inside of the tub." So I would like to think that in my thinking as a career police officer, I have a fascination for those things that have few moving parts, those things that can be uncluttered in our thinking, and those things I think is those things are where we can find the genius of the solutions to the world's greatest problems. So if you will, I'll give you a few shower curtain initiatives of my own as to how I look at this problem of policing, and particularly my experiences in Africa and having grown up in Africa, in the Congo, and in working with the United Nations and across that continent in a variety of places, including being in the DPKO at New York, overseeing police operations in 17 of the UN missions, 6 of them in Africa. So I had a wonderful experience, and to be able to take that passion forward in that way was a wonderful experience. Well, here are some of these initiatives. Number one, it takes time. Unfortunately, we have this sense of urgency that is both a motivator for us and a detractor. Wyatt Earp, the famous gunfighter, was asked one time, what is it that you teach your students? And he said, in every gunfight, when you encounter a fighter, take your time, but hurry. And I think in between the generation that is needed and the golden hour that is right upon us, there's this thing, we have to do something right away, but we have to institutionalize it quickly and not expect too much out of it before Christmas. I mean, we see, I think, in conflict situations in the post-peace accords or in military interventions where the building of the police structure seems to be the exit strategy for the military. It is not the exit strategy for the military. Police capacity building is a generational thing, and it takes a lot of time. I was asked by a general one time referring to Haitian police, where I had gone back and forth on a number of occasions with a colleague, by the way, Michael Jajic, who's here with us. Where are you, Michael? At the time, when USIP, and he and I share a love for that country and its police structures. Well, how soon can you stand up the police in Haiti? By this general with 3 stars. And I said, how soon do you stand up your family? I just left it at that, Socratically. But the idea is you're not going to do that as an exit strategy. You're going to build your family as an institution that will someday be responsible as they move forward. So it takes time. Number two, we have to depoliticize. And that is a tricky one also, because as you heard from our former speaker, the accountability of the police under the political structure is essential. But corrupt political structure that seems to want to dominate the police and get them to do what they want, nepotism, patronage, corruption, and the like, that is the curse of African police. Third, we have to demilitarize. In post-conflict situations and the crises that are taking place, even now as we look at what's happening in Syria, what's happening in Mali, what has been happening in the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, we see the convergence of police and military. Even in Afghanistan, Iraq, unfortunately, even those who have built police, they seem to throw them into the firefight of the counterinsurgency. That's not where police belong. Police belong serving the people who need policing structures in their neighborhoods and villages, not out here being cannon fodder against an insurgency. That is not the role. C-O-I-N, not the role of police. So we have to remember it takes a generation. We have to depoliticize, we have to demilitarize, and we have to remember no one is an island. You heard it best by our former speaker who talked about the need to bring things together in a systemic way. I hear often of SSR, security sector reform, and they don't talk about the police, they talk about military. I hear justice sector reform, and they don't talk about the police, they talk about judiciary. Or even when they talk about rule of law reform, they're talking about judiciary and maybe prisons. But you said it best, Maturin, when you said that it has to encompass all those structures. And you cannot isolate, no one of those is an island. And the effectiveness of all of those structures work together in reform initiatives, this is the way to go. I could go on and I won't in need of a future. Next and sixth initiative is that it's never the wrong time to do the right thing. And community policing is always the right thing. Unfortunately, the community policing is defined in a wide range of ways, many of them in various papers that I have read completely superficially, let's say, if not inaccurate and without experience. Community policing at its heart has the problem solving, community service, community engagement, buy-in by the community, working together with the community while keeping the lines separate. It is not a soft, squishy approach to policing. It's a very strong approach to the powers that can be generated with the synergies that are there in the community. That's community policing. I know it. I love it. I've worked it. I've fostered it. I've advocated for it many, many years. And many will say, well, at the early stages in post-conflict situation, it's a little early for community policing because they're a little sophisticated, you know. And I say, no, this is the time for it. Right at the time when people are at the deepest level of conflict and crisis and suffering, that's the time to bring the police that will help and serve them, be accountable to their needs, solve their problems alongside of them, be trusted by them. That's never the wrong time for that. Next initiative is that we need to measure. Now, I have a friend, Ian Mitroff, who has written many books on crisis management. He has a great quote in one of his his recent books where he says we have a tendency to measure all the wrong things precisely. And when it comes to measurement, unfortunately, as I read in the papers and I hear about things that are going on in the world today, and I hear about training, and here's a report in the New York Times about we have trained this many police in this country. And I ask myself, what does that mean? And what is that number? It's one thing to say we have trained these police. The question I would have is to do what? To be what? To how? To think how? To perform in what manner? To be accountable to whom? Not just we've trained this many. You can say that and take police through a two-week training program, and that's almost what it is in some parts of the world in the post-conflict situation. And training programs are very, very superficial, shallow, and very quick, and they turn out police that don't know what to do. They haven't built into them the fiber of community service, and then they're thrown into the counterinsurgency. That's not a police officer. That's just another number. Might as well count beans. Next initiative, of course, is that corruption is the primary adversary in everything that goes on in Africa. And unfortunately, I think we may have approached this incorrectly. In many cases, you know, we talk transparency. Who's against that? Anti-corruption. Who's against that? As I would meet in Liberia as a police commissioner, who here is against corruption? Everybody's there against corruption. So I took it on myself as we started the development of the Liberia National Police after that conflict to instead of going anti-corruption, let's talk pro-integrity. Let's talk about what it means to have core values that include integrity in your list of values. And what does that mean specifically to you? Now, when we put somebody out of the police academy, they know what integrity means. Now, that's just not a number. That's somebody who has absorbed a policing core value and is going to live by it. Not all the time did they or do they live by it. I'm not saying that. I would be a bit of an idealist, which more than I already am, I suppose. Next and close to the final one would be the reform, restructure, and rebuild. We have a tendency to stop on the second R. And I would tell you that it's so easy to be able to lecture another society. You know, you come from places where everything is nice. And, well, in the LAPD, we did it this way. In NYPD, we did it this way. And that's not what is needed. I had so many people tell me, you know, you lecture me about this stuff. What we really need is some things. In Liberia, after the war, you can imagine everything looted, everything stripped. There was nothing for the police. They were crying for. They had two cars in Monrovia, police cars, Liberia National Police cars. So rebuild, reform, and restructure. Reform, restructure, and then rebuild. And then that, you would put a comma there, according to a plan. Because if you bring these various players together and you have a national consensus, a buy-in, if you will, and all those things that our former speaker, Maturin, mentioned so eloquently in his collection of institutions that need to be brought together, and you just reform them and you restructure them, that does no good. If you rebuild them, we're getting better. If you rebuild them according to a plan, that's the best, because then you move forward. Now, the final note is about donors, and I would say, and Richard asked me to say a word about donors, and I have experienced what I refer to as donor interference, donor dissonance, donor disaffection, whatever the other D's that you'd find in that list of donor problems. Well-meaning people who come from various countries to give something. But I would call for donor coordination to enhance the reform, restructuring, and rebuilding strategic plan. Then we have something that can be of value, because if a donor comes in from this country or that, and there is a menu, and that menu is operating as a portfolio of needs that have to do with reforming, rebuilding, restructuring that police inside of that society, and in addition to all those institutions, then you have something that is really worth something. So there you have my shower curtain initiatives for the afternoon, and an open invitation, more important than these things that I would say, perhaps, is whatever question you would have in your mind, and I'm open to have them as well. Thank you very much.
Mark, thank you very much for that. Plenty of issues for us to talk about in the Q&A. But first of all, we're going to pass on to Eric, who's going to tell us how he's done it in Sierra Leone specifically. Over to you, Eric. Thank you.
Thanks, Richard, and really appreciate the invitation. It's a privilege to be here today with all of you. Just wanted to start by saying that what I'm going to talk about, this initiative in Sierra Leone, was the result of tremendous collaboration and teamwork among the U.S. Agency for International Development, the State Department, the Embassy in Sierra Leone, and the Justice Department, ICETAP. I've worked at ICETAP for 15 years. Just to reiterate what Matt and Mark have said, I've seen in my work on programs throughout Africa that exactly what they're saying, that the problem of oftentimes having a divided focus on police and civil society. So the idea behind this program, election security program, was to bring together the Department of Justice, ICETAP expertise in terms of policing with AID's focus on civil society around elections. And the result, I think, has been encouraging. I want to give you just sort of a snapshot of that, if I can. We started in November of last year. ICETAP put in a police advisor, Brian Atkins. And initially, the Sierra Leone police wanted us to work directly with the community outreach office within the police in terms of civic education. We knew that we needed to pursue both, educating the police in terms of what they needed to know about their role around the elections, and at the same time pursue civic education so that Sierra Leonean citizens understood what the police should be doing so that they would hold them more accountable, as Matt and Mark have discussed. So our advisor spent a lot of time getting to know the senior police officers, building trust. He attended the weekly executive management board meetings. One of the initial problems was that contact with the outreach unit was not happening. The director of the outreach unit was very busy, so it was very hard to do that coordination. So Brian, over the course of several months, actually 4 months, developed a good relationship with the director of the training unit in the SLP. And I agree with Richard's contention in his paper about the danger of sort of hitching your wagon to a dynamic individual in an organization. But I would also say that sometimes it's absolutely necessary if you want to get anything done. And in this case, it had a positive result, I believe, because Brian was in a very difficult situation in terms of developing contacts within the organization in terms of how we would forward the initiative. So the training director was a very committed person. He'd worked with the British on the security sector reform initiative that had been implemented earlier. The result was that he and Brian developed a good working relationship, and they formed a training committee that met regularly at Brian's apartment. So over the course of about 6 weeks, the training director and four other people, including the chief legal official in the police, met and talked about the training needs that would revolve around training needs that the police had and were needed in terms of civic education for the elections. So out of these meetings, informal sometimes, a lot of trust was built. And in the end, there were about 9 areas that were agreed on that needed to be really tackled. Some of those include police neutrality, gender discrimination around elections, understanding election laws. These are all areas that were absolutely critical. Sort of complicating this process was that they started and actually developed training modules, and then new election laws were passed in May. So during this process, there was this focus on how can we best implement this training. Training is a tactic, as Richard points out in his paper. It's not a strategy or the final end. But I would argue in a case like this, where we had very limited funding, about $585,000, a fairly short time frame, and we had something specific that we were looking to do, training made sense. And the type of training that we worked with to convince worked with the Sierra Leoneans, sort of advocated with them, talked with them. The training director also within the organization advocated for it. A micro-training approach, which some of you may know as roll call training in the U.S. and other countries. And the idea is to take very short periods of time, sometimes 5 minutes, up to 30 minutes, to focus on a particular issue that police need to know in order to do their jobs better. So for this election initiative, like I said, there were 9 areas that we were really looking at. So how would you develop this approach in terms of those 9 areas? We thought it was essential that we have uniform lesson plans, that all of them basically be in the same format. So you have objectives, you had the narrative, you had a summary, and then very simple 5 true-false questions. You know, what did you get out of this? What did you learn? So we took this approach, and again, there was this behind the scenes, how do you sell this this concept? Training in Sierra Leone over the years has been very expensive. Donors complain about it. The UN, DFID, is a big problem because it focused on bringing a small number of people into Freetown for a week to 4 weeks of training. That's very expensive, and it's not very efficient. So the end result of this program was developing with the Sierra Leonean master instructors. There were 10 of them. So giving them basic instructor development training in terms of adult education and techniques, in terms of what is important in terms of getting this developed. And then actually developing these modules themselves. Each of the 9 training modules started with a role play. So, for example, in gender discrimination, the role play was about 10 seconds long. You had a police instructor, a woman, standing up, and she was a candidate on the campaign trail, speaking to her constituents. A man comes in and shouts her down and says, "Get home, your place is in the kitchen." That's about 10 seconds, ranging to other ones such as understanding the new election laws, which got a bit longer, say 3 minutes. But this is part of African tradition, the skits, the role plays, and yet they weren't integrated into their training methodology. The training methodology, very rote. We've all seen this around the world. So changing the training methodology, inserting questioning techniques, a Socratic dialogue, if you will, in very simple terms. But again, very short, so no more than 30 minutes. The 10 master instructors that we developed then went out to 32 of the 34 police provinces in Sierra Leone, trained about 730 police commanders, community outreach officers, civil society leaders. And then those people then went to the police stations and outposts themselves. Every morning there's a morning parade, which is when the commander gathers the police together, spends between 40 minutes and an hour and a half talking about different things. So the mechanism was in place to actually implement this. And that was a very good thing, because that was, at that point, the police were sold in terms of that as a vehicle. Very quickly connected to this in terms of civic education were police peace concerts. What I mean by that is Brian Atkins, our original advisor, in February of last year, first met with a local musical group, fairly well known in Sierra Leone. They agreed to develop a CD for the elections promoting peace. Two of the eight songs were specifically mentioning positive things about the police and how citizens needed to reach out to them and help solve problems with them. And that CD was completed. AID paid for the marketing of it, so it was played in radio stations all over Sierra Leone in September and October. So we had a peace concert in Freetown. The police came out. They did some of their micro-training initiatives. We had political party representatives, NGO representatives, talk about what they were doing around the elections in terms of promoting peace. So again, the idea was combining that police education with civic education. And finally, photographic posters, very simple pictures that, and you'll see that on the front of the report, very simple photographs that show with a check what the police should be doing, an X showing what they should not be doing. This was presented all over the country. All the police stations in Freetown had these posted. They were posted in Bow and McKinney. So there's a big effort to get this out. I coordinated with the press officer for the police. It was a real collaborative effort. In the aftermath of the elections, well, first, some of you know the elections went well. The police conducted themselves in a professional manner. Some of the observer missions, specifically commented on the performance of the police. And they've done, a very good job after the elections overall. Richard points out in his report there's many, many issues, obviously, with the police. I think one of the greatest things that I've seen, one of the biggest points of hope there, is that the Inspector General of Police, Francis Munu, is really committed to building bridges with civil society. And I haven't seen that really in any other African country that I've worked with. But he was committed to building a better relationship between the police and the public. And this continues to carry over. So Rick Collins, who's our advisor there now, has worked with the police training school to continue this micro-training approach. The master instructors have worked with 14 new instructors at the police academy. They have developed on their own 6 new micro-training modules dealing with ethics and values. They've also looked at other larger training initiatives for criminal investigations. So obviously time will tell whether this has a long-lasting impact, whether it's sustainable. But to me, it's hopeful, and I think it's a strategy that should be considered because I believe it does promote sustainability. This type of initiative can, as I've tried to explain, bring civil society and the police together in a constructive way, help police better understand what their roles are, have the public better understand what the police should be doing and what they can do to help. Obviously, there's a lot of roadblocks, as Matt and Mark have pointed out. But to me, it's a hopeful initiative, and time will tell. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Eric. And yeah, thanks for the great photo, which we've been able to use on the report as well. I'm going to open things up for discussion, questions, comments, your ideas. I know we've got a lot of expertise in the room, and including many who've helped in this report as well. So thanks to all of you. Maybe I could start by asking the panelists. You know, we've heard, and I think we understand the need to be patient, that police reform is a long-term endeavor. It's difficult, it's tricky, we shouldn't expect results overnight. But the political reality here is such that, you know, the people funding these activities, they demand quick wins, that funding is tied to very short budget cycles. And there's a demand for the kind of metrics that we've heard and are perhaps not that useful. Numbers through the academy, number of police cars and equipment handed over, etc. So how do we square this issue? And more broadly, how do we raise the importance of police reform up the political agenda here? So I'm interested in your ideas of how that might happen. Maybe while you think about some great answers to that question, I'll open the floor up and we'll take another couple of questions as well. So let's start. Please identify yourselves when you ask the question, and let's start over there with Mark. Microphone's on its way.
Thanks. Mark Cohen from Oxfam. A question for all of you, including you, Richard, and Eric touched on this a bit, but if you could say a bit more on the gender dimension, and I'm thinking of not only recruiting and training female police, but developing trust so that women turn to the police when there have been instances of gender-based violence, domestic violence, etc. So kind of two faces of a gender dimension.
Okay, thank you. And let's take the gentleman in the middle there as well.
Hi there. Mike Jobbins with Search for Common Ground. I was wondering, you talked a bit about accountability to civil society and within the judicial sector, but what about accountability to other parts of government? I'm thinking in particular of National Human Rights Commissions or the Parliament or other cases where you've seen other government institutions playing a key role in strengthening accountability for performance.
Okay, thank you. Well, let's start with that set of questions, and then we'll come back for more in a moment. Who'd like to kick off and tackle whichever question or questions you feel you'd like to?
Okay, thank you, Richard, and thank you for your question. Regarding the very first question, Richard, you raised, there are two aspects to it as far as I'm concerned. It is true that most Western countries are facing some, you know, financial problems on their own. And to me, it seems like we don't have to go in. We do not have to, okay? If we do and decide we need to go in, we need to make sure we think about the whole kind of ends, ways, means approach that we teach often. We tend to go in with the money we have, as opposed to determining the end, we need to go and look and seek for the money. If the money is not there, forget it. But to go halfway and just feel good, do something, and wash out and say, thank you, I've helped DRC 20, 30 years, they are still fighting, that's simply not right. If we are having financial problems, we don't have to go. We don't have to be the police of the whole world. But we cannot go in with this, I have $10, so I'm going to buy this. No. Do I need this one? Yes, I need to find how much it costs to buy it. That's the first issue. Now, the second one, reform policies in Africa cannot be more important to the U.S. than to African leaders themselves. Mm. why do we think or assuming reforming the police in Africa is really important to the U.S.? Why? Maybe they don't want it out there. So we need to make sure that we are on the same wavelength in terms of what it is, as opposed to wasting money, and at the end, we are losing on all fronts, basically. To me, that's what I think it is. Now, for us from and the question about gender mainstreaming, I don't think this is just police or even... In Africa, we have a deeper issue with the whole gender. It's a societal issue that we need to go and address. If you look at it from police or gendarme and whatever, we will be missing the whole point. What is the role, what is the place in contemporary Africa today of women? That's, to me, what we need to address. Once we fix that one now, we will raise it up to how many of them should be where and how we treat them overall. And by the way, that's not just Africa. Even the U.S. here, we are a long way. Accountability, to me, should be all, across the board. That's what I was talking about. This is a holistic approach. We are not just talking about, the police and or the security sector proper per se. The justice system, if you have lawyers who are all corrupt and crook, it's not going to work. If you have people who believe if you go to the police station, you are not going to have justice served, you are not going to them. You find your own way to resolve your own problem. Or these are kind of, so accountability should be across the board. Everybody should be accountable. Thank you.
Thank you. Just to complement what was said, I don't want to repeat because I agree. But I'll just add on the issue of, that golden hour, those moments where some money needs to go there, we need some quick wins, we need something visible. I have seen the good results, frankly, of traffic. In every post-conflict situation around the world, after the conflict, there are cars on the road now, and things are moving, and there's congestion, there's gridlock everywhere. And one of the things that I have seen operate to great impact were, since the police are the most visible, since traffic is one of the pressing problems, since the police are then seen in a visible and professional way, not stopping cars to get small. We said in Liberia, what's the speed limit of Liberia? 50 Liberian dollars. Yeah. And not that. Yeah. I mean, just a very, very specific, sequestered, if you will, traffic management plan, good traffic engineering, developing the traffic police so that the traffic can flow smoothly, visible police everywhere, seeing that that's done. That's what people see. And it sends the signal that, okay, there's an orderly thing now while we do this longer-range approach. So I just recommend that as something that I've seen work very effectively. And then to then give me the opportunity to put a comma there and add that if we focus on only things like that are visible, then we build a superficiality that is really not sustainable. With the first unplugging of the financial dollars, there goes our sustainability. So I would quote here Sir Hugh Trenchard, the architect of the Royal Air Force. Famous quote of his was, "I wish to build a cottage on the foundation of a castle." And I find that in police development often we see the castle as that beautiful uniformed police officer. Underneath, there's nothing. And so that's one of the reasons I'm proud to be part of PAE, where in Afghanistan, for example, we are on a contract basis providing an assistance on how to service your vehicles. That's not the castle side, that's the foundation side. So we build institutional, long-range, sustainable structures based on the footings that we're building. They're not visible. People don't talk about how do we teach the Afghan National Army and police to take care of their cars. That's not very, there's no sizzle in that. But that's one of those long-range things. After we are long out of there and the DOD takes its way and then behind that DOS takes its way, what do we leave? Some folks that know how to keep their cars on the road. So there's early, there's a long range. And then finally, I couldn't agree more on the question about human rights and commissions even those commissions have to do with reconciliation and those kinds of things in post-conflict, very, very important. And I would offer that if you deeply entrench the core values into the various institutions, all of them, and then you in the reform process, which is not only an intellectual process but an ethos change, a sea change, if you will. If that takes place, and then with the police, there's a community policing alignment. In that community policing philosophy, there's this very deep commitment to the human rights of other people under the law. So if that takes place in that matter and you have a commitment in that way, it's not that human rights will ever take care of themselves, because we need strong leadership and accountability, as was the gentleman that asked this question. In this particular area, and I'm deeply committed to that. But I think that again needs to be brought into the whole structure. On the gender, my daughter, a Los Angeles police officer for several years, would be the better one to talk to you about being a female cop. And what her expression to me often was, and she would wear the nameplate, the same one that I wore for 32 years in Los Angeles police, and she would say, somebody say, "Are you Chief Crooker's?" And she said, "Look at him, yes," but she didn't want to be known as a woman or a son of a law enforcement executive. She wanted to be known as a police officer who has her own capacity. This is what I'm devoted to in building police: women who are police, rather than police who are women. And so, I mean, there's that thing. And then, of course, in Liberia, very proud of the fact that I was able to recruit from India the first all-woman foreign police unit that went to, I talked to the Indian ambassador and the permanent representative of the United Nations, and there they sent them. And then we had this great discussion about, well, how can you send an all-woman police? Well, how can you send an all-men police? My question was. And by the way, they're not all women. The cooks are men. I was quick to say. and it was the truth in that particular unit. But it was a lot of fun. And not only fun, but institutionally in Liberia, the example that was set, the connections with which, I know, Richard, if you studied that, you know about this unit and the great reputation they have now, many deployments, and the respect that they have generated, not only for the Liberian National Police, as they had this linkage, but for the policing profession. And it's not about women, it's about the policing profession. These are the women who do it. And so there you have it. There's the broader picture. I think women want to be police officers to be police officers. And sometimes we overdo the gender discussion on that point, and I'd be the first to join that discussion, but be careful about making too much of the fact that a police officer is a woman. You should police officer and put a period there. As far as my daughter, that'd be her lecture to you.
Thanks. I'll just jump on the back of that and say that, yeah, the all-women form police units have made quite an impression in Liberia, and just their very presence is really sends a message home, I think. So I know, Mark, you said it's not just a question of number of women cops, there's more to the issue than that, but I think that is part of it. And something else I noticed in Liberia, again, the president has set a quota for female police officers, which the police have struggled to meet because of kind of wider societal problems with education, that women have not, you know, benefited from as good an education as men have. So there have been specific efforts to train, to provide literacy training for women recruits, and I know some people in this room have been involved with them to try and help them pass the recruitment exams and up their numbers. And I think, I don't know what the latest figures are, but I think it's about 17% of the LNP now is women. Is that roughly? I think the number, yeah. Sorry, I butted in before Eric was going to respond.
Well, just to your point first, I guess one of the things I've observed is, and Mark addressed this, the need to analyze what's going on in terms of the crime and the police institution. And as Matt pointed out, a lot of these institutions are still operating in the colonial mindset. So you have sworn officers who are doing nothing more than acting as chauffeurs or electricians or door openers or coffee and tea servers. And then you have calls to double the size of the force Well, you may not need to double the size of the force. You need to really analyze what's going on, and that's a threat usually to the people at the top, because that's part of their power, is how many aides do you have. That's a tough issue, and it gets back to civil service reform, which is really, really tough. But I think if you were talking to a senior policy person, one of the things I've experienced is, in terms of, and you point this out in your paper, we go in sometimes in these situations where everything is broken, and we talk about an overarching approach to solve everything, and that's not going to happen. And sometimes if you take very finite approaches in certain areas, I think Mark's example is good about the traffic issues. But another area is just understanding what the people themselves need. I mean, going into Sierra Leone, there was a culture there of accepting anything that was given, and this is true all over the world. We go in, or the U.S. government or the international donor community goes in, and it's not it's not a malicious thing, but we have certain ideas, and we offer them, and they accept them. But there's not the necessary dialogue up front to really establish what the needs are and what they can do in a sustainable way. So we complain about sustainability, but I think a lot of times we don't spend enough time listening to them and their needs so that we can actually work with them to create sustainable programs. In terms of your gender question, I think that's obviously a huge problem. In Sierra Leone, they've created family support units, which are staffed with quite a number of female officers. One of the issues they've had in recruiting women to the police, the literacy issue is one. So they are working to try to get more women on the force. Right now, the percentage is quite low. But I would say also, I think going back to the power of the individual, Esther Cantor, who is one of the master instructors, she's an instructor at the police training school. She's one of the most powerful orators I've ever heard. So when she got out and did the micro training all over the country, and when she stood up at these peace concerts and addressed the public and the police, people really listened. You had to listen, because she's very forceful. So getting people like that in the force can start to change the culture. But there are no set answers to that. But sir, your question about the rest of government, I think one of the interesting things I observed in Sierra Leone was at the executive management board meetings, they invite outside guests to come in. A couple of times when I attended, they had the Human Rights Commission come in. One occasion, it was just after the report was issued on Bumbuna, which was an incident that with a mining company that Richard describes in his report. Very contentious issue. The police were criticized for improper use of force during the incident. But I thought it was very interesting. The chief of police, the deputy chief of police, and all the senior commanders had a very civil discussion with the commission. They were very respectful. They disagreed on a lot of the points, but it was a setting a stage for, I think, useful dialogue, which I think, again, goes back to leadership and, you know, what type of leadership do you have ultimately in the organization?
Thank you. Let's take another round of questions. Let's take two from this side, David, and then lady at the back.
David Throop, CSIS and Johns Hopkins. I found the panel's discussion extremely interesting and insightful. But I have some concerns. I should explain that I'm, in fact, the historian of the Kenyan police force. Have also been victims of crime in Kenya and Sierra Leone, and therefore have had recourse to the police. And it strikes me that there is a fundamental cultural problem, that even in a place like Kenya, perhaps particularly in a place like Kenya, the police is a low-prestige profession. Nobody wants to be a police officer if they can do something else, and certainly not even a police your local constable, but an inspector or whatever. It's not a high prestige job, and never has been. The police throughout Africa are very poorly paid, and therefore it seems to me that you're not attracting the best possible individuals. Very few university graduates going into the police force. And that has consequences. When I had my dealings with the police in Nairobi and in Bo, I found that there was an extremely hierarchical culture, that the ordinary policeman whom one first met at the police station couldn't actually do anything, that everything depended upon the officer in charge of the police station, that even the sergeant or the inspector didn't feel it was within their remit of authority to take any action without the approval of the senior police officer at the station. And if he was not there, and quite often he was not there, nothing at all got done. So it seems to me a fundamental bottleneck in terms of African perceptions of hierarchy and cultural authority that have to be grappled with. There is no incentive. In fact, there are disincentives for anyone who shows initiative as a low-level police officer. My second point is I spent some time with the International Police Training College in Botswana, and I actually sat in some of their police training sessions. And they had a number of police officers largely from East Africa, but also some from the DRC. And it struck me that what they were being taught was perhaps not entirely appropriate. It might have been entirely appropriate for Washington, D.C., but it didn't actually resonate with the realities of the situation on the ground. And the fact that many of the courses there are staffed by short-term individuals seconded from the United States seems to me a fundamental problem, that they come with best practice attitudes and how we deal with these kind of things in the U.S., but not to be implemented in the African context.
Thank you, David. We'll take a question at the back there.
Jennifer Thaxton, I'm from Department of Defense. Mr. Crooker, during your remarks, you mentioned that police capacity building should not be relied on to facilitate military exit. Could you talk a little bit more about what that transition should look like in a post-conflict situation?
Okay, thank you. Any more questions? We'll take one more there. Thank you.
Office. Thank you. And I want to piggyback off of your comment. You made the comment that there's no wrong time to do correct action. One of the problems to do the right thing. One of the problems we've run into in both Iraq and Afghanistan in trying to build a community police force is you're trying to build a police force that can deal with community issues but are also able to deal with an insurgency that is, generally speaking, much more powerful than the police force. I think DOD has come to the realization that to defeat an insurgency, it needs to be police primacy, military and support, rule of law. But in that kind of situation, before the military is ready to exit, when they're trying to make the conditions amenable to community policing, you're trying to keep that police officer alive, number one, protect your investment. Two, you're trying to teach them to deal with the insurgency. And three, try to teach them to deal with community policing, all which, as you'd mentioned, is a generational problem, and those definitely do not go well together when you're trying to teach one individual. So if you'd comment on how kind of grassroots, how you can do community policing in insurgency and then exit strategy for the military. Thanks.
Okay, great. Well, the whole range of questions there. You got something on, you know, how do we get over this sort of fact that, that policing Africa is a low prestige profession? Some comments on curriculum, training, suitability, the police-military relationship, and community policing. So feel free, Mark. Why don't you lead us off?
I'll just start in with that the first list of observations. In my notes, low prestige, low pay, hierarchical structure that produces dysfunction, disincentives, and training often irrelevant and out of sync with reality. And to all of that, I agree in some places. On the contrary, I think I would caution myself and you, collective we that care about Africa, to be careful for broad-reaching conclusions, even based on a certain criminal being a victim of a crime, because what that's consists of is anecdotalism, which is one of the diseases of post-conflict discussion. And that is, we take an anecdote and we convert that to the reality of things. And what I was trying to say in my very brief remarks earlier was that it's very important to take a reading, a navigational latitude and longitude. We have to know where we are, and we have to have that based on some form of empirical, methodologically pure approach to analyzing where exactly we are, rather than some paper that a student wrote, or even the wonderful paper that we have here and point of discussion today. Dig deeper. Let's mine the data. Let's get the community surveys. Let's get the expert opinions on a broader sense, because you describe a variety of dysfunction, but Africa is a huge continent. And I would just remind myself, in my experience in Liberia, the young police officer with the finest of information, the deepest of knowledge of community policing, and the most articulate in expressing that in helping me to embed that into the Liberian National Police was from Zimbabwe, of all places. And he was from a Zimbabwe contingent that served in that mission, and he brought with him, you know, probably answers to almost all of these issues that you brought up. So I'm just saying, we need to be empirical. We have snapshots, but we need to be careful not to take those snapshots and define them as the reality and try to build a broad picture of the way things are. Curriculum review, yes. Incentives, yes. You know, building positive reputational brand development of police agencies, yes. That's all part of. I'm very proud to be a member of the Botswana National Police. Now, that's a long way in coming, perhaps, in some circles. Yeah, would they say I'm more proud to be a member of the Botswana National Army? Probably. Which brings me then to the question about the counterinsurgency and military. So then, to talk about what I had intended in post-conflict situation with militaries, and what I've seen, in particularly in Africa. Now we're mixing Africa with Iraq and Afghanistan a little bit. There is a comparison, a little bit there is no comparison. So we just have to acknowledge that, and I'm sure you'd agree. But when it comes to Africa, that Western Ridge, for example, that was ablaze a few years ago, and the Great Lakes that were ablaze a few years earlier, even my beloved Congo that to this day is ablaze in the East with war, conflict. What happens is the illicit structures who fight, the fighters, they produce a nexus of power to which consists of an attractant to young men and women, even children, to go and fight, be a fighter, be a rebel, or be a contingent member of a certain political thought based on some military leader. I recall a certain general in Liberia named Peanut Butter. General Peanut Butter and I had many fine discussions. His real name is Adolfo Dolo. and we developed a certain affection. But I think he is a fighter, would be part of a militant military group. And so post-war, my remark was to separate from that and build a police that is part of coming out of someone's home, not out of the fighter world, and to build someone who can react to the human rights needs, to the law, to someone that says, that person stole my goat. What are you doing about it? Help me with this. That's all I have is a goat. And to respond in compassionate ways, record it, investigate it, bring to justice the person who stole that person's only possession. That's what I'm talking about, apart from and demilitarized police. When it comes to the Afghan and Iraq situation, that is very different, and I acknowledge that it's different. However, I think when 5 years from now we look at both of these two countries and we have the remnants of the engagement, we will have a picture that is different than the one we imagined. And that is my question for that picture. Not what we are doing today and the IEDs and things that are damaging the and threats to the people that are there. That is a deep need, and it's a daily need. Fed intelligence and reaction and tactical plans and all that has to be done. But my question, if it's generational, if police capacity building is generational, what will Iraq and Afghanistan look like 5, 10 years from now? And that's, I guess, where to weigh in on the side of a community police, building them, protecting them, as you say, you know, and making sure that they don't get killed. But also, let's not train them in 5, 8 weeks of training. Let's give them a police academy in longer range when we can do that. Meanwhile, we have the daily requirement of our survival and their survival, and that's a reality. So mixing Africa and Iraq, that's a little difficult. But there you have that. Honest answer to your question.
Thanks. Eric, would you like to?
Yeah, I agree with Mark. I mean, everything you've listed is hard to dispute. But I would say, for example, the pay. Obviously, that's an issue. But I've seen an example in Uganda where in early, 2002, General Wamala Katumba, who was actually a military general, was appointed the chief of police. He came in and he told the government, the government, parliament, everyone who would listen, my constables aren't paid a living wage. Was told by parliament, sorry, can't help you. Ministry of Finance, sorry, can't help you. So on his own, he took a look at the entire police structure. And there had recently been a corruption investigation done by a former Supreme Court justice. Using that, he went through and fired a number of senior officials and somehow found a way to double the salaries of the constables. That's a leadership issue. And leadership is rare. Good leadership, I think, is rare, whether it's in Africa or Norway or Washington, D.C., wherever you are. It's a rare commodity. So I think that's one thing. Going to your point on training, I personally feel that law enforcement, international law enforcement academies have a purpose, but they also, as you describe, I don't think they're particularly effective at developing host capacity. And there are advantages to having people come together in a regional setting, but I would say, as I've found in different countries, there's a lot more advantages to having donors go in and work very closely in the host country with the police to develop their own training infrastructure that makes sense and ties in with the overall institutional development of the organization. So I think that's really important.
Thank you. And Matt, we started with you, and we'll finish with you. Final word.
All right. Thank you. I just want to briefly address the issue of cultural problem and remind everybody that the pre-colonial Africa was police before European came. So we had what was like a community police, if you want to call it that way. It was not in the interest of the monarch to have anybody beat the subject. There was a minimum of decorum in terms of attitude. But with colonialism, a police became the tool of repression. Okay, when you witness, you see the kind of beating, what happened. So the police doesn't have that good press in Africa in terms of our history. Now what happened? The new leaders, instead of transforming that, changing that perception, they have never been able to do that. Therefore, go to police is like the last resort. I mean, you fail everywhere else. Some people go fishing or farming as opposed to go to police simply because of the reputation. Nobody really likes it. That's really what I think is kind of happening. The second issue you raised, which is the bottleneck and all this bureaucratic, is just a scheme, a corruption scheme. What it do is the police is observing on top, the minister, the president, everybody is corrupt, crook. They are all stealing money. So they design their own small way because a state is supposed to be a continuation of action. A police is supposed to be part of the whole state apparatus. So because a constable or whatever is the police chief is not there, doesn't mean everything should stop. But they do that purposely. And this day, you can even if you have an accident, you have to buy gas before the cars will go and see what is going on. So it is just their own way of devising system to kind of, take their, what is, their portion of the pie. Now, the third issue, which is one of culture, whether there's any universal culture, you have that debate in human rights. If you have police officers or trainers who go with already made template modules in the U.S., Norway, everywhere, when they say go to Botswana or Abidjan or somewhere, instead of thinking about the culture, think about other things, we are just too lazy. We take what is there already, and we just want to go, here you go. So we need to, it seems to me, we need to go back and think about it. Yeah, we want to go and help. How can we help them as opposed to what we have to give? Thank you.
Thank you. And we're just about out of time, I think, now. But it's been a really a great discussion. Thank you all for coming. And I know many of you here have helped during the research for this report. Go away and read it, and please respond. We would enjoy your criticism, feedback, and also your thoughts on how to take this issue forward as well and continue work and research on it in useful directions. Please join me. We've had some great discussion, great guests with their different and unique and engaging perspectives. Matt, Mark, Eric, thanks so much for being here today. Thank you.